The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You are now Skeptically Speaking on CJSR, where we ask you to call in and question everything. Here tonight is a night chock full of adventures and ill preparation with having my cheat sheet in front of me. And you should learn to not only question me, but especially question your host, Desiree. Take it away, Des.
Thanks, Sean. Hello, everyone. Today we're going to be talking about cults with Dr. Stephen Kent. But first, let's have some speaking up. We are in the studio today with Brad Solomons.
Hi.
Hello, Brad. He's the author of the lovely local skeptical parenting blog, Skeptad. So, Brad has something to say about potty training.
Yeah, I do. For those who aren't familiar with the blog, Skeptad has been online for about 18 months, and that's about as long as I've been a parent, actually, so it's been an interesting experience. The purpose of the blog is really to not give advice or answers about parenting, but to get parents to really think about what they're hearing in terms of all sorts of skeptical advice. You know, being a parent makes you really vulnerable to a whole host of new product claims and advice claims and that type of thing. So what I tend to do is dip into some aspects of parenting that, you know, are really rife with all sorts of great crazy claims or neat products, and potty training, that's right on the agenda when you got an 18-month-old. So I did some research on that, and I found actually a whole list of crazy claims and crazy advice and crazy products that all come down to trying to get your kid to use the toilet. And who'd have thought? I've grouped these into a couple categories, and of course there's tons of information on the blog. There's a whole bunch of links to some of these. I've referenced a lot of this information, so if you want to check it out, skeptdad.com. But for now, I'll go through my short list of some of the wackier claims. I grouped these into two categories. First one is really communication based, and you know, so why should you be skeptical about these type of things? Well, they're really, people buy lots of books or they read lots of websites, and they're full of wacky claims, and they set really high expectations for parents. And I mean, if you're a new parent, and why do you have to have this advice in front of your face?
And you're spectacularly vulnerable at that point as well.
Totally.
You're willing to buy anything to ensure that you have the next genius child.
Yes, exactly. So there's some really basic stuff like positive reinforcement. In the right context, kids can be trained, say, in a single day, like the train in a day method, and this is all broadcast. And, you know, hey, you get this done, and you're really setting high expectations for parents. And it's really preying on this whole idea that, oh, you have to do this instantly. It's the TV dinner parent, you know, be there, do it quick, get in, get out, it's done. I came across a site called the Potty Whisperer, which is very...
Are you joking?
No, I'm not.
Oh,
it's very Pavlovian, I guess, if you want to call it that. A quote from the site: you start by briefly whispering a watery sound such as sorps, sorps in your baby's ear at potty time, and this, the child helps to learns to associate this sound with releasing their sphincter muscles. And so this is actual advice. And if you go to the site, it's full of all sorts of pseudoscience mumbo jumbo, innate tempos and this kind of stuff. And, you know, I don't know. It really makes you wonder who's writing this. But there's the infamous, now I've come across this a number of times, it's called the Naked and $75 Method. And you can get all sorts of books on this now. And the premise is that children will not tolerate urine and feces running down their legs. So if you let them run around free and do what they will, they quickly learn to use the potty themselves.
Have these individuals met children?
Yeah, I don't know. The $75, of course, is to clean your carpet when you're done. And, of course, again, tons of pseudoscience, tons of mumbo-jumbo on this, and really preying on parents who are looking for that quick fix on doing the potty training. Of course, there's the other category is all these products that you can buy. I'm sure everybody's seen the ads, big kids diapers, Huggies pull-ups or Pampers easy-ups or whatever. I mean, really what you got is a diaper that has got some sort of chemical reaction in it. So when the kid wets himself, they feel cold or wet, or, you know, it's supposed to encourage, and it's supposed to be like training pants, so really gets them that next step. But I mean, really, you go to the store, these things are way more expensive than regular diapers. They're a pain to use. We tried them out, and they don't work at all. They didn't work for us anyways. And you know, you want to look at this skeptically. I mean, isn't this just the diaper industry trying to keep kids in diapers longer? I don't know. Yeah. So, I found a stack of links to all sorts of dolls. Like, for example, Potty Patty, which is an anatomically correct drink and wet on demand doll. It's $50. Comes with a DVD. Yeah, it's a doll. It's a doll. $50. You know.
This is painful.
It's amazing.
What would you say to parents who are, you know, everybody wants a quick fix, but most of us realize that that's probably not always going to be possible.
Well, I mean, it's generated a lot of discussion on my site, and actually the advice that other people are giving is that, you know, really it comes down to patience. I mean, you want to do this right. You want to be a parent that is realistic and skeptical. It's patience.
So this is not only training you, I mean, training your child, this is training you as well.
Oh, this is more about training the parent.
Perfect.
You know, and if you're not getting trained as a parent, you're getting sucked into things like potty boot camp, which there's actually a class, a $300 class in Chicago where you can, and I'm sure this is bound to be a franchise opportunity at some point, but you've got people paying $300 to show up for a day and basically have a potty drill sergeant run around with your kids and feed them lots of sugar and treats, and boom, hopefully they're trained in a day and, you know, guaranteed to work. And apparently this woman also sells an ebook online. So in your desperate hours, you can go download for $5 this ebook off the internet. And it's a PDF file with all this advice you could probably just find on the internet anyways. But, yeah, it's there. And, you know, it's total marketing, total profit generating stuff. And, you know, makes you wonder who's buying this stuff, but yeah.
Well, I'm depressed. Good. Mm-hmm. And then, thanks, Brett. Do you want to plug your site?
Yeah, for sure.
I'm so glad I don't have an 18-month-old. You just, honestly, I am every day, but really today especially.
For
thanks.
Sure. Well, yeah, it's a jungle out there. But yeah, check out skepdad.com. I've got lots more information like this and others. And yeah, thanks.
Perfect. Thanks very much for being with us, Brad. All right. If anyone out there would like to have their say on speaking up, do send us a brief email proposal to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com, and we'll see what we can do. And callers, if you do want to get in the phone queue, call us at 780-492-2577 extension 1.
I was going to do the whole say CGSR with Des, but she went with the numbers. So.
I'm sorry.
We'll need to rehearse next time.
Okay, right. Where was I? Oh, email. You can also get a hold of us by email. And that's live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or if you have a question of less than 140 characters, please do send it across at Twitter @SkepticRadio.
Skeptical Radio.
Which is totally not the same.
Yes, when it comes to the internet, one little letter can make the biggest difference in the world.
I know. So we have Brownie in here. It's time for Brownie in Motion, people.
Boy, I know what that's like, having one letter make the difference. I won't even tell you what site I was trying to look up, but I went to the wrong one. Anyways, how are you guys doing?
That sounded like that was going to end up obscene, and you decided to clean that up.
Well, yeah.
Okay, nice.
I thought
thanks.
I'd leave that one alone.
I appreciate that. Okay.
Even I have a filter sometimes.
So what do you have for us?
Well, today I'm going to talk about artificial life, or A-life, because apparently on the internet and in academia, there are too many letters, and so they had to shorten it up. But where this came from was, I like fiddling around, especially with computers and computery stuff. And particularly because I have an interest in biology and evolution, I was interested in looking into some artificial life simulators online and ended up finding some. So I just wanted to talk about some of the more interesting ones that I've come across. And in fact, two particularly, sort of spanning the initiation of artificial life software and where it is today. So first of all, one of the first, and I still think really interesting, examples of artificial life is John Conway's Game of Life, which is not so much an evolution simulator as an example of cellular Automata. Something like that. Anyways, it was developed way back in the 70s, back in pencil and paper days, and as a game, and was actually published in the Mathematical Games column of Scientific American. So what it is, the game of life consists of a simple orthogonal grid, so little squares of whatever size, in which the grid cells, the grid squares or the cells are either alive or on or dead or off. And the life universe progresses through discrete time periods or generations. Now, each cell in each generation is evaluated, and in the next generation either becomes alive, either stays alive, or dies, or stays dead, depending on the living or dead state of the cell itself and the 8 adjacent neighbor cells in the current generation. So it sounds really technical, but if you see an example of it, it's not all that hard to figure out. So, for instance, a dead cell becomes alive or becomes born in the next generation if it has exactly 3 living neighbors in the current generation. It stays alive if it's already alive and has 2 or 3, or dies and stays dead if it has any other number of living neighbors. So, but what's really fascinating is from these rules and fertile initial starting states, life will give rise to all sorts of interesting patterns there are static ones, ones that move, and ones that spawn other patterns that might go on to spawn patterns after that. And they've got all kinds of crazy names, gliders, glider guns, honey farms, bakeries, French kisses, hive nudgers, and spaceships. And spaceships are an entire class what are these things called? What did I call them a minute ago? Patterns. I don't know what's with my... I might need more coffee. But what's fascinating about this is how many of these patterns occur naturally without the programmer having to explicitly program them in their initial state. And thus, the game itself demonstrates both self-organization and emergence, such as we saw last week with the swarm algorithms. But even further than that, you can program in complex structures such as logic gates and Boolean operators, and they're created through the interaction between patterns, and which suggests that an infinitely large game of life running fast enough could perform the functions of any theoretical computer. Now that was the sort of the start of cellular automata and computer simulations of life and evolution. Now, where we are today, based on similar ideas, programmers have been using computers to test models of biological evolution. One of the most well-known and successful of these is a program called Evita, which started about in the mid-90s by 3 researchers at Caltech, and now it's being hosted at Michigan State University. Now, in Evita, digital organisms compete with each other for CPU and memory space, and after that they reproduce, can mutate, and essentially, they're instead of metabolizing sugars and carbon molecules as biological life, these ones crunch numbers. And what I mean by successful is that the work done with Evita has spawned a number of peer-reviewed publications in journals such as Science and Nature. So by setting conditions so that the reproduction rate is sped up or slowed down depending on whether the organism successfully produced some outcomes, such as successfully summing numbers, and letting the organisms then reproduce at will, they've been able to replicate most of the features we've seen in actual biological evolution over time. So, for instance, in one experiment, they attempted to replicate the equals procedure in computer programming, which is a comparison between 2 binary numbers to see if they're the same or not. Now, it's a trivial problem and one that's solved, but it's not really trivial to program. And I think when they tried to actually program in the smallest, I think the smallest number of lines they could use was 19 in order to run this entire function. So to evolve that would take all sorts of permutations. So they tested this out, and what they did was they rewarded organisms that carried out complex operations, not necessarily ones that were summing, but any complex mathematical operation, more, and they rewarded, but to a lesser degree, ones that carried out simple procedures. Then they ran the experiment for 16,000 generations and did it 50 times. In their first run of all this, in 23 of the simulations, the organisms not only evolved the equals procedure, but in each iteration, they evolved a different way of solving the problem, sometimes really complex, sometimes more simple.
Interesting.
And what's even neater about that, so I mean, that demonstrates, you know, that, you know, when we see examples of convergent evolution, like the multiple times that eyes have evolved, or wings, or any number of the structures that are relatively homologous but have different starting points evolutionarily. What's even more interesting, and one that will probably frost a few creationists, and actually did, was that some of the endpoints they reached were programs that were irreducibly complex. So if you took out any of the initial steps or any of the intermediate steps and removed them, the whole program would fall apart, mm-hmm. which is something that creationists, of course, have been saying can't have happened in evolution. And yet we know that that it can, and this software essentially demonstrates that again.
But again, this is a computer simulation as opposed to real life.
Just a computer simulation. And exactly, just by little computer-modeled organisms that sit there in memory and CPU space and then reproduce and can be... And can be programmed, or at least given an incentive to reach some sort of end goal. So in that way, it's slightly different than evolution as we know it now,
right.
as it occurred on life, because we don't have an end point. But nonetheless, if we see these procedures coming up, then that's still fascinating. I wanted to also mention the Evita team. They've also teamed up with, and early on, I think about 4 or 5 years ago, when they were starting to run this software, they ran into Richard Lenski, who's a relatively well-known microbiologist. I believe he's a microbiologist, and he'd been running an experiment with, I think, a variety of different strains of E. coli, starting with initial strain 21 years ago, and letting them just evolve and evolve and evolve and move on in its time. I don't know much about his research, but I do recall there was a brief time back in the summer when Andy Schlafly of Conservapedia tried to get Lenski to give him all of his data because he didn't agree with the results.
I remember.
And Lenski wrote a few humorous and like exquisite put downs of Schlafly, pretty well. Yeah, criticizing his ability to think, which I think isn't too hard to do.
Oh, that's a lovely way to put it.
Yes.
Criticizing his ability to think.
Not hard to do, and I do things like that all the time, but never as well as somebody like Lenski can do. So that's all I wanted to talk about today. One more thing about Evita. Because all of these organisms replicate and move on, like bacteria, they've seen the evolution of whole ecosystems and how those interact with different strains of these silicon organisms having different functions and manipulating numbers in the same in different ways, and have seen some interesting interactions between them and how they fill up a space and how that space or how many of these species can be defined by how much they feed them in terms of numbers and CPU space and that. So anyways, in this week's blog post, I'll be posting the links to these, but I've also got a whole whack load of fun little simulations, ones that are more aimed at the layperson to play with, and you can tweak and let them run and see what develops. So check out this week's Brownian Motion blog post, which will be up on Sunday on skepticallyspeaking.com. And yeah, have fun.
Wonderful. Great. Thanks, Brownian.
Thanks, Anthony.
And we have a special message now.
Yes, we do. Yes,
we'll be right back.
Let's get that
going. Here at Skeptically Speaking, we encourage you to call in and question everything. During tonight's episode, you can call us at 780-492-CJSR extension 1 to join in the conversation. Again, that number is 780-492-2577 extension 1. Well, feel free to comment on tonight's episode at skepticallyspeaking.com. We'd also love to see you join our Skeptically Speaking Facebook group or have you follow Skeptical Radio on Twitter. Of course, if you want to reach us the old school way, you can email us at feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com.
All right, we're back. Dr. Kent joining us in just one moment here. Did want to point out a bit of a funny observation we noticed, that the potty training was the lead-in to Brownian Motion. That came via Turk,
wrong.
Not me.
Wrong.
Not me.
That came via Turk?
Turk, yeah.
Thank you, Turk. It's time for our main feature. And before we get started, I just want to say again, the number is 780-492-2577, extension 1, or by email at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or Twitter @skepticalradio. And you can reach us all those ways.
And the email address actually works this week. It was not quite working for our first show, but we got it all up and running again.
Perfect.
So.
And actually, on that note, thank you everyone who was who commented on the new format of the show. We very much appreciate the feedback. And continue, please. So our feature tonight is we're talking about cults with Dr. Stephen Kent. And Dr. Kent received his master's and his PhD, actually, in religion and modern Western society. Is that correct?
I think so.
Okay.
It's been a long time.
At McMaster University. This lovely gentleman has published a myriad of research papers on a number of different cults and different aspects of them. And he has a Wikipedia page. He currently teaches undergraduate and graduate courses that explore religion and deviance here at the U of A. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right. And we are extremely happy to have him with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So let's start with the basics for lay people. What kind of characteristics would really define a group as a cult?
It's a controversial question, really, because many people feel that the term cult is pejorative, that it demeans people's beliefs and actions. What seems to be the case, however, is that people who use the term cults mean it to be that the belief system is unorthodox and somehow spurious. It's harmful, it's manipulative, it deceives people, and so on. It's possible, for example, to have some orthodox groups that do harmful activities, and it's also possible for some groups that are unorthodox not to be harmful at all. So there's a whole range. A lot of my colleagues say they avoid the word cult, although even those people often publish books with cult in the title because people know what it is. You know,
right.
It's catchy.
Right. Okay. So how would... What do you use instead of the word cults?
Sometimes I use the word cult. Sometimes I just avoid it and call these groups groups. What I tend to focus on, however, are groups that are outside the mainstream, groups that probably don't have a lot of their own members doing objective histories or analyses of what goes on in those groups. So the groups range. I've studied groups in the 17th century. I studied one in the 2nd century, a lot of contemporary groups. And what's always interesting is the unusual behaviors that go on in the name of religion, in the name of devotion.
What kind of unusual behaviors?
Because people attribute, and a lot of social scientists would say misattribute, divinity to leadership, people in the context of giving devotion to their leaders will do and have done extraordinary things. I mean, we think about the mass murder suicides and suicides that have gone on in recent years, some of the kinds of almost blind obedience that goes on to leaders throughout history, really. One of the interesting aspects of studying these groups is that one gets thrown back into history. The activities that I've seen in some contemporary groups, I've also noticed in groups from hundreds of years, in a couple cases, thousands of years ago.
Interesting. Okay. I guess one of the things that when I was mentioning to people that I was doing a show on cults, one of the questions that they had was, you know, things like Scientology and Satanism and Mormon fundamentalism. These fall into the cult, whatever word you'd like to choose, but the cult category. But how is this different than... Okay, what I'm trying to say is, if people join a cult, people want to do interventions. If somebody joins the Baptist church and goes to church every Sunday, people don't do interventions. So what makes one group more socially acceptable than the other group?
It is true that, especially in the 70s and 80s, when people joined some of these high-demand groups, parents frequently would hire people at the time called deprogrammers. And sometimes those deprogrammers would actually use force to try to get people out. So there are incredible stories about kidnappings, holding people. And the reactions, by the way, of the people who were, quote, kidnapped deprogrammed was quite varied. Some people are extremely thankful that parents and friends did the activities. Other people were terribly bitter about what happened. So it's a wide range. And probably the indications about what would motivate someone to try to get a loved one out of one of these groups has to do with the person's perception about harm or potential harm that the group is doing.
Okay.
So many of these groups, for example, require that individuals cut off contact with family and friends. Now, realistically, some family and friends probably worth cutting yourselves off from. It's not not all family and friends are nice, but in so many cases, these groups place demands upon people to renounce their former lives and turn themselves over completely to the guru, to the swami, to the teacher, to the new belief system, and so on. People change their names. People turn over all their belongings and so on. So it's those kinds of extreme activities that often would motivate parents to say, what happened to my kid? You know, I've known this person for 19 or 20 years, and then within a few weeks or a couple of months, it's a complete personality transformation.
That's just, you mentioned deprogramming, and one of the articles I believe you co-wrote on deprogramming and how it isn't really the same as it used to be. Did you want to explain that?
Sure. Deprogramming in the early days, when it first appeared in the 70s and through the 80s, often but not always involved various kinds of force. And force could be in the context of grabbing a person or confining a person or pushing ideas on a person that he or she didn't want to know about. A number of the deprogrammings, now, those people called deprogrammers, if they had the option, would not use force in those days. And there were many deprogrammings that were in various degrees voluntary. So there's a whole range from involuntary and violent to voluntary activities. Because, however, a number of deprogrammers who used aggressive techniques got in legal trouble. There were lawsuits and so on. A couple of deprogrammers got convicted.
From family or from the individuals?
What often would happen is that the deprogramming would fail in the context of what the parents wanted. And the person, the target, would go back to the group and often with the group's assistance, would sue the parents. There are also a couple times when the state initiated kidnapping charges against deprogrammers. So it's a risky business. I know of one guy who had someone take a pot shot at him. I mean,
really?
It was dangerous. It was very dangerous. And consequently, as often happens in social movements, people started to professionalize. So as more and more social workers and people with various kinds of counseling training got involved in the cult information, or if some people call it the anti-cult movement, they started to realize that for professional reasons, we can't do these kind of violent, we have to prohibit them. And they developed a series of professional intervention strategies that required permission of the person. So that the current they now call themselves exit counselors. The exit counselors will not do an involuntary deprogramming any longer. There has to be some consent on the part of the person to stay in the room and converse and hear the information.
Well, I can understand that, you know, in a certain way, but if somebody has been, you know, isolated and has been, you know, thoroughly brainwashed within that group, I have a feeling that they might not be that willing to stay in the room.
I know, and it's a complicated world. One can imagine scenarios, for example, that if a parent could have done an intervention with an adult who was in a high-demand group like Heaven's Gate or Jonestown and didn't because of concerns about ethics or the law and so on, and then saw the consequences, you know, the murder-suicides that happened afterwards, they would take their regrets to the grave. And so it was always a delicate issue with parents who believe that they were indeed assisting the person because they claimed the person could not think for him or herself, whereas the groups themselves said this is freedom of religion. Mm-hmm. These are adults, often young adults. They have the right to make decisions on their own. It's interesting, and in many ways tragic now. I've talked to quite a number of people who have been in high-demand groups 15, 20, 25 years. So the crucial aspects of life development, the 20s and 30s into their 40s, sometimes even older, have been devoted to a cause they eventually see as illegitimate, as spurious, and they've lost a tremendous part of their own life possibilities. So people are in their 40s and 50s and just going to university, never been married, never had children. Sometimes people will be in groups and are pressured to have abortions and so on. So they're high prices people pay very often for involvement in these groups.
I want to talk some more about this, but we have a call.
Yes, we do. We have Tark on the line, probably to get me back for announcing his role in the pun. Are you there, Tark?
Yes, I'm here. And no, I wouldn't come after you for that. I'm seriously considering changing my name to the Potty Whisperer. I really like that.
Go ahead with your question, sir.
Well, I was kind of curious if Dr. Kent has seen any studies. I'm interested in prevention. Have there been any studies to sort of indicate what sort of behavioral trends or personality traits that would tend to have people get sucked into cults? And can we head that off, or, you know, can we avert them somehow?
It's a good question. And sometimes schools do have preventative education, but there are very few organizations now that are conducting, cult inoculation, you may say. People often have predisposing factors that lead them to define their problems in religious as opposed to psychological or economic terms. In those contexts, if those people set out to be seekers, if they're out looking for answers in religious contexts, and they come in contact with a group, and that group enhances social interaction at the same time that that person diminishes or cuts off interaction with the outside world, then there's a pretty good chance the person is going to convert. Indeed, many conversions come through existing social networks, through family and friends. Consequently, we can help people see the patterns of cult conversion. I've also shown some videos to high school students about magicians, and these are people who, as you know, can do extraordinary things, and they are not supernatural, though they often appear to be. So we can help show people that individuals exist out of the world who are out to get their bodies, their minds, and their souls. But a lot of people are going to fall through the cracks, and even some of those people who have been, you might say, inoculated, still may fall prey. I had one of my very good students a number of years ago turned out to have grown up in a high-demand group. And even after she took my class, she got sucked in by the guru and had a couple of weeks of sheer confusion until she sorted things out. So it's a lot of people can fall prey.
Okay, so it's really not generally socially dependent people. There actually have been strong, independent-thinking type individuals that have gotten lured into cults?
I know this. I've interviewed probably hundreds of people who've been in groups, and a great number of the people I've interviewed are far smarter than I am. It's just the case that I'm asking them the questions because, for a number of complex reasons, they made often unfortunate choices about their lives. So it certainly isn't a matter of intelligence. A lot of people have come from very good families. Breeding skepticism is a good thing. Getting people to really ask questions and push is pretty good, too. One other context, I often talk to people about techniques that some groups use to recruit, which is to put people in circumstances for which they have no prior interpretive experience and then give them an interpretation. Best example is some groups that use high-speed chanting or chanting in a foreign language and so on. If you can get a person to sit down with friends and do these kind of activities for 45 minutes or an hour, and they will have no idea what's going on and will want to give meaning to their lives, if a group and or friends come along and say, this is what you've done, you've been in contact with the ascended masters, the higher forces, then a number of people will buy it, and that's an entry point into the group. Other groups, look, everybody has personal issues, things in their past that they probably regret. Groups will use various techniques to get people to confess, to renounce their past. And in doing so, people have an enormous sense of relief, this tremendous unburdening. That's also another way people get into groups.
Did that answer your question, Tech?
Yes, it did. And you and Sean keep up the good work, please.
Wonderful. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Mark.
Bye-bye.
And I believe we have another call on the line.
Yes, we do. I believe it's Nathan, who is the number two caller tonight.
Oh, Nathan is usually our first caller.
Yep. Tark beat me.
Go ahead, Nathan. What's your question?
Well, my question really revolves around how often do you find that mainstream religion or cults would become a mainstream? For example, when we take a look at like what happened with Jim Jones, we had this charismatic leader lead a bunch of people off to a faraway land, then kill a bunch of people who came through his area. Yet, for example, the Mormons did the same thing. Charismatic leader leading the congregation out to found their own colony, and they had their own little massacre, the Mountain Meadows Massacre. How often would a group like that become considered mainstream and a regular phenomenon?
It's a good question, Nathan. By and large, I should say by far, most of the groups that appear will die out. Some die out in a couple of generations. A few will carry on for a few hundred years. But for the most part, they don't make it. There's only a few religions that have gone on for generations, if not millennia. There are a couple of indicators about how a group can survive. One is that it has to have to be in some tension with mainstream society, but not in too much tension. A second technique that some groups use, and Mormonism is a classic example, is it says that its teaching is an extension of existing belief systems. So the Mormons will talk about the Book of Mormon as a further teaching of Jesus Christ. So moreover, if groups can win over the second generation, if these groups can keep children involved in the group, then these groups are on the way to possibly mainstreaming. It's also the case, too, that these groups have to appear in environments that are not extremely hostile to them. If a group were to appear, well, if you look at, say, Falun Gong in communist China now, it's under severe stress by the government. So there's a number of factors that help a group to continue.
Okay. Did that answer your question?
Yep.
Wonderful.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Oh, sure. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Hi. All right. So it's time for a little promo here. This one was partly the reason I didn't have my cheat sheet in front of me today. So I hope you appreciate 5 minutes worth of rush editing, but somehow it came out okay. So here we go.
This is Desiree, host of Skeptically Speaking, Edmonton's only skeptical call-in talk show. Next time, we'll be talking about nuclear power with Dr. Jeremy Whitlock, reactor physicist and manager of non-proliferation and safeguards at the Chalk River Laboratories. Nuclear power has so many detractors and proponents that it's difficult to figure out what's fact and what's propaganda. It's the perfect topic for a skeptical show. So what's the difference between weapons-grade and fuel-grade uranium or plutonium? What does it mean when someone says Iran is building a light water reactor? And the big question, is nuclear power safe? Find out on the next Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m., here on CJSR.
All right, just before we continue on, I do want to remind our listeners that they can call us at 780-492-2577, extension 1, live at skepticallyspeaking.com or Skeptical Radio on Twitter.
And again, we're here with Dr. Stephen Kent. We're talking about cults. So, Dr. Kent, you co-authored an article titled When Scholars Know Sin.
There's a story behind that title. That wasn't a title I chose. The editor, without my knowledge, chose it.
Interesting choice. What was your title?
Oh, I don't. It was some stuffy academic title. You see what happened? There's a story here, and it's an interesting story. I and a graduate student at the time wrote an article for an academic journal that was very critical of the way a number of scholars in this field were relating to and writing about these controversial groups. If you can imagine, these groups really want good publicity. Mm-hmm. Consequently, they often make themselves readily available to academics, and the academics who have access feel privileged. What the academics really don't take into account, however, is that these groups have done house cleaning before the guests arrive. So a number of studies have been really quite bad. And so we wrote an article for an academic journal, and we named individuals. Well, the editors got a hold of it, and they wrote back and said, oh, it's not convivial or congenial, collegial was the term, to name individuals. So they made us go through and strip all the names, all the individuals we named. And I said, this is nonsense. So we published the article, but I went to, I think it was Skeptic Magazine, and put in the names. So I put in the names, and then when it appeared, the editor had chosen this one, Scholars No Sin, because the illustrator thought that he could do nice drawing sketches. And I just threw my hands up. So we got the message out, but it came at a cost of trying to say that my colleagues were sinful. And that's not my – I don't care if they are or not.
That was not the point of the article at all. So, well, can you give us a couple of examples from that article of different things that researchers have, I guess, who have become less objective than they should be?
Oh, there are many examples. I did a couple of articles a few years ago about Scientology's what I called forced labor and reindoctrination program, the Rehabilitation Project, mm-hmm. Force, or RPF. Subsequently, Scientology gave access to several academics to an RPF program in England, and these academics wrote a report about it. Never got published in a book or a peer-reviewed journal, but appeared on the internet, saying essentially, this is not a bad program. There's really no pressure. People get sleep, adequate food, don't work too much, and so on. Just a few days ago, I got a hold of a book written by a former Scientologist who said he was in England at the time that Scientology was preparing for the academics to come over. And he said the background preparation prior to their arrival was extraordinary. Went on for several weeks. They were fed well. They were rehearsed. They were told what to say and so on. So the group knew they were coming. And the Children of God, another group I've studied, actually had set up what it called media homes. These were homes designed to receive reporters, academics, any outside interested parties. The Children of God had gone through their personnel and removed. I talked to one woman. I think she was 17 or 18. She was a single mother, had a young child, and she got booted because it didn't look good. They had gone through, and I've got the documents here. They had taken razor blades and cut out pages, controversial pages, of group publications, and they had a good curriculum. It was clean. They were well fed. Consequently, I know one academic went on television, and she said, I went through, and she rolled her eyes and said, thousands of pages. I saw nothing about abuse. Well, of course she didn't. They had removed all this controversy. The group had book burnings. So when academics went into the media homes, they saw what the group wanted to present, and the people who had access to the documents prior to them being burned were saying, you got duped.
And I find this interesting because after being shown that they have been duped, what do the academics, how do they react? Or do they refuse to believe that they have been?
Well, science is supposed to be detached research. We're supposed to objectively look at facts, and if the facts present something otherwise, we're supposed to change our minds. In reality, a lot of personal sense of self and self-worth gets tied up with mm-hmm. research. Consequently, my own interpretation, what often happens is that I think a lot of my critical work on groups gets ignored. I see books that have come out on – there's a new book out on Scientology. There's a fairly new book out on Children of God. And the articles that bring out sensitive issues don't appear. Moreover, I often see people who may have been involved in some questionable earlier studies – continuing to repeat the pattern. So if there's more out there, and there's more out there that reinforces their position and ignores critical positions, then in the long run, in say 20 or 30 years, when people are looking up research, they're going to go to those books. So it's, you know, when I started off as an academic, I thought facts were facts and they'd speak for themselves. But there is an area called sociology of knowledge, mm-hmm. and that area talks about how we identify what's a fact, how we think it's important, how it gets written up, transmitted, and accepted or rejected by the academic community and the wider world. And there's politics to it. What I find is a lot of reporters and people who've been in groups are often much more receptive to the critical material. There's a real gap between, for these high demand groups at least, for former members and their statements versus many academic accounts about what life was in, what life was like to be in them. Indeed, there's a whole tradition in my field of categorically ignoring the accounts of former members. Don't even talk to them. It's not a matter of hearing what they say and testing to see if you can verify what individuals tell you. It's a categorical denial of former members. They're biased. They have agendas. Ignore them.
Interesting.
It's very strange.
So academics don't have agendas.
Oh, academics have tremendous agendas.
All right. Interesting. You were also actually even called upon quite a few times to give testimony in legal cases.
Most of those cases don't go to trial. A couple have. Groups or cases involving controversial groups have a lot to lose in many instances. These groups often don't want a legal precedent set against them. So very rarely do these actually go to a decision. So I've written a number of reports and expert testimonies, once or twice. Twice at least, maybe more, been deposed. Once or twice been on the witness stand, but almost none of those cases ever go to either jury or judge decision.
Because I know there were some high-profile ones, obviously, with the ritual abuse cases.
The ritual abuse cases. I got a lot of flack for my work in the area of people claimed to have been ritually satanically abused. I actually did testify. It's a case I did testify out in, I think, Stony Plain, in a case. Social services brought me in. And, you know, social services had really no agenda in this case. And it was a real tragic case in many ways. The mother was on her second round of kids, and I think she was such a bad mother, the first round of kids came back to testify against her for the second kids. But these kids had just amazing stories about what really sounded like satanic abuse by the boyfriends. So there wasn't the hard evidence, though. I got various levels of evidence, but not enough ever to go to lay conviction. So sometimes I get different people in the same family telling very similar stories. Now, you can argue possible contagion. In one instance, we had two people. There's another researcher in Calgary doing this study. He came up with a person who claimed to be in the same group as someone that I had spoken to, and these two people hadn't seen each other in 9 years. In another instance, a person gave me permission to get her medical photos from a hospital. So I went to a hospital and picked these up myself. And she had a burn, a cross burned on her cervix. And she said the group leader did that to her because she'd thrown up on him. How do you prove that? So it's levels of suggestive evidence. But my first case actually involved someone whom later I found had a long history with the police of suspicions about satanic abuse, but you couldn't prove it. It is the case that some of the accounts were not proved. In one case, someone said in that corner, 4 feet over, 5 feet over, 5 feet down, there's a buried pickled fetus. Okay, fine. We dug, it wasn't there. Another instance, I did an interview with RCMP, a woman who's in a safe house down here. And after we talked to her for about an hour and a half, we finally figured out she's paranoid schizophrenic. You know, the stories, she couldn't go into a story. It was just vague and around the corners. It sounded as if she may have been severely abused by a boyfriend at one point. I mean, the stuff about the gun to her head was very plausible. But the other things, I went out with the police outside the city once to a person who was holding down a job. She was had a profession of some sort, and she was being every night they originally abuse her. Well, what are they doing? How are they getting? They're getting in the window out there. Well, there's snow on the ground. We went outside. There's no footprints, you know. And then she brought a book out and had underlined very clear cases of schizophrenia and so on. So, I was actually involved. I did a ride along with the police. And there was a murder in Mill Woods, and the husband tried to cover it up with spraying satanic words on the wall. And, you know, I walked down the stairs, and there was the dead body. And, you know, so it's a complicated issue. I don't know. Given the human depravity, it wouldn't surprise me if people come to believe that there is a god of this world and that god of this world is evil, or sexual deviants want to sanctify their deviance and do quasi-dark religious rituals. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Talked to a graduate student today. He was at a heavy metal concert in Germany, and they performed Black Mass on stage. So, I mean, it's out there, but it's complicated.
Well, this seems like a good time to bring in a caller with a quick question. Their name is Truth. I don't know if that's a pseudonym or their true name. Are you there, caller? Caller, are you still there? Oh, let's try the other. Oh, still working the buttons. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Sorry about that.
Hello.
Hi, and my name is Truth. It's not a pseudo name.
Oh, okay.
Lovely.
My question for Dr. Kent. Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Hello, Truth.
My question for you is, what are you working on now, or is there a current research project that you're working on that you could share it with us?
I'll share some things. What I was working on this afternoon is another article about fundamentalist Mormon polygamy. It's an issue that, of course, keeps coming up in this country now that there have been two charges laid in British Columbia and Warren Jeffs' conviction in the States. Big debate as to whether the polygamy law is going to be upheld as a criminal offense in this country or whether it's going to get thrown out. My prediction is it's going to stand. My prediction is that the polygamy as a criminal offense will remain on the books. There's a lot of debate about it. Beyond that issue, if I ever get this paper finished, I want to go back to some more work on child sexual abuse and alternative religions. There's an extraordinary number of stories about kids being sexually abused in these groups, an extraordinary number. And they go back for a couple hundred years.
Well, isn't it true that there's a lot of child sexual abuse in a lot of mainstream religions as well?
Oh, sure. If you look at the mainstream groups where we would think that accountability structures exist and people are more integrated into society, not afraid of authority figures like police and so on, and yet we still see abuse in these groups, to look at the amount of abuse that goes on in groups that don't have accountability structures that teach their kids that the outside world is scary and dangerous, it's extraordinary. Some of the most shocking stuff I found is when parents, often mothers, actually will facilitate the sexual abuse of their kids by leaders. There are one or two groups where mothers actually chased down their kids, their daughters, in order to take them to leaders for sexual abuse reasons. It's quite astonishing.
All right. Does that answer your question there, caller?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I do have a quick question here on Twitter. It's pretty interesting. Apart from time, what differentiates the major world religions from modern cults?
Aside from time, cultural context often matters a great deal. So, for example, the Hare Krishnas, you know, the devotion to Krishna goes back for hundreds, probably well over 1,000 years in India. When it hit North America in the late 60s and early 70s, it certainly had a cult status. Now, however, because of the influx of Indian immigrants, the Hare Krishnas have evolved from what critics used to call a cult into a fairly mainstream immigrant religion. It's also the case, too, that the number of Western converts has diminished. But that's an interesting movement. So there's a whole cultural context there that helps explain how some groups get labeled in one culture one thing and another culture in another way.
Thank you, whoever tweeted that. I actually just I think this might be our last question. We're almost out of time. I assume you're familiar with our local College of Integrated Philosophy.
Yes.
It's the followers of John de Ruyter.
Yes.
You've spoken publicly in an article I read about this, but what do you think of that group?
Well, John de Ruyter is a local Edmonton, he calls him, a spiritual teacher to his followers. I believe he portrays himself as the living embodiment of truth. He's attracted a lot of members who had been through previous religious groups like the Rajneeshis. And my sense of when I used to go to John de Ruyter meetings is that if you were to take a Star Trek tractor beam and beam it down on the hill at the folk festival and suck up those people and send them into a room, they're the John de Ruyter followers. They're
right,
older.
Right.
There's some gray hair. There's some paunches. They've been spiritual questers for a long time. And I'm of that generation. And I must say that for a lot of us, getting older has been a real shock. We expected to live in the dawning of the age of Aquarius. And instead, we got Brian Mulroney, Margaret Thatcher, and Ronald Reagan, and then the Bushes and Stephen Harper. So it's been a real shock. The world didn't unfold as we expected. And a lot of that generation was really looking for something spiritual. And John de Ruyter, because he says relatively little, people are able to project into and onto a silence a lot of their own personal needs and meanings and so on.
And that's what I found fascinating, is he will go, you know, up to 40 minutes just staring at a room full of people, and that's his technique. Until there's people crying falling on the ground, and this is, would you consider that a cult?
Well, I call it a group, and I have in the past, not terribly recently, I have in the past gotten phone calls from parents and friends in different parts of U.S. and Canada saying, what's going on? My friend gave up everything and moved to Edmonton. The group, I think, has a sign in the back now saying something to the effect that we don't do psychological counseling, but it's very clear that, at least the meetings that I saw, that some people have tremendous emotional needs, and they spill their guts to John, and maybe they get satisfaction from his answers, and maybe they don't. But these are, I think, decent people for the most part, trying to make sense out of their lives.
And on that note, thanks very much, Dr. Kent, for being here tonight. And thanks very much to everybody who was on the show this evening. And thanks to Ryan for answering the phones oh so quietly. And to Sean for generally being awesome. And we also have our photographer in the studio tonight, Mark Julian. And Brownian is somewhere. So everyone have a very good night, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
See you then.
Things sometimes fall out.